Support for WPR comes from Tomorrow River Community Virtual School, delivering Waldorf-inspired live virtual lessons to grades 4K through 8th, open to all Wisconsin students. More is at trcvs.org.
Support for WPR comes from the Dram Corporation, based in Manitowoc, Wisconsin. Manufacturers of professional-grade handheld watering nozzles, sprinklers, and cutting tools. More information is at dramm.com.
It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Jean Purcell in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, are we a nation of workaholics? A new study finds that we leave lots of paid vacation time unused each year, and our guest makes the case for the value of leisure and laziness.
As recent Supreme Court decisions dominate news headlines and same-sex marriage rights gain momentum here in Wisconsin, some pundits are saying that social issues will have more impact on the outcome of this year's governor's race than economic issues will.
Back in 2006, social issues were a big factor in the governor's race as the state's constitutional amendment on same-sex marriage was put to voters at the same time that Governor Jim Doyle sought re-election.
Since then, our country's gone through a recession, and economic issues have been at the forefront of most campaign agendas.
So what are going to be the deciding issues this year? Charles Franklin joins us with some insight into this question. He is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and the founder of PollsAndVotes.com. Charles Franklin, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
I want to start out with this idea of social issues because, you know, in the last couple of years, and deservedly so, I guess, we've heard a lot of economic issues. Social issues in terms of playing a role in gubernatorial campaigns, where has that gone lately? Has it just been as simple as the economy has been so terrible that that's what we've been focusing on?
Well, as simple as it is, I think that is really the answer. Whether we're talking about national polling or here in the state, people continue to rank jobs in the economy as by far their number one concern. But that doesn't mean people don't have views and concerns about a variety of other issues, including social issues, but also others like the environment, for example. I think looking ahead, the question is how much do the campaigns choose to emphasize social issues as the basis for choice and to differentiate themselves on those issues versus choose to leave those issues to the side. And again, you could think of environmental issues as another example where the campaigns might choose to talk about it but might choose not to.
Well, let's use this fall's gubernatorial race in Wisconsin as a stage to set that question on. If I were the Republican incumbent, Governor Walker, what would my thinking be on social issues right now? I've got a track record. People can look at it. They can see what I've done for the last several years here in Wisconsin. Do social issues help me or hurt me?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the interesting questions. Governor Walker has been relatively quiet about those things, about social issues. And when he has been directly asked about it, he has said that those aren't topics that people bring up when they talk to him. But he says, people know my position on these. I've got a long record as a social conservative. But that's not something that I'm going to talk a lot about. Mary Burke, on the other hand, has stressed her support and expressed her support for same-sex marriage, for example. And so there could be a defining difference there between them in terms of do the campaigns want to talk about this? Again, I think part of this is where the public stands on these issues. The other is the extent to which the campaigns see it as in their interest to emphasize social issues rather than economics.
So in other words, the stance that a campaign takes on whether to use social issues or not as part of their campaign, that could change throughout the course of the campaign, could it not?
Certainly it could. We've seen previous campaigns raise a variety of issues and raise them in interesting ways. So in the 2006 gubernatorial campaign, Governor Doyle talked a fair bit about stem cell research and its potential medical advantages, especially in the case of diabetes research. That was widely seen as an issue that could attract some otherwise Republican voters, particularly women suburban voters, who might be less willing to restrict stem cell research if they thought about it in the terms of medical research, though they might be less supportive if they thought about it in terms of embryonic stem cells. So that's an example from the past of a campaign that chose to use a social issue, but to try to define it in a way that was helpful for them. Also, of course, in 2006, we had the statewide marriage amendment, which passed with 59% support, which this year seems to see a reversal of that. In our Marquette Law School data, polling data, we see 55% support for legalizing gay marriage.
And that particular issue points out the fact that sometimes social issues are come up because of what happens in the news. I mean, sometimes one day you're not talking about it, the next day it's a headline.
If a court rules and, you know, the same-sex marriage issue is on appeal, you know, then that can intrude in the campaign. Other court decisions or potentially activities of interest groups can also bring this up. So some of it is in the control of the campaigns, but a lot of it is out for, you know, outside events to intervene. You know, we haven't mentioned a couple of others like immigration reform or legalizing marijuana or an area that hasn't changed very much of people's views about abortion rights and limitations on abortions. All of those are issues which outside forces could raise, but they also remain up to the campaigns to decide how much to emphasize them.
So let me ask you this. Are these issues that get people to vote, or are they just something to talk about?
Well, traditionally, we've seen social issues as a mobilizing element for the strongest supporters in each party. So the irony of abortion rights is that both those who want to protect the right to life and those that want to protect a woman's right to choose both use the same issue to mobilize their supporters because their strongest supporters feel so involved about that issue, even though they hold opposite positions. But the majority position on abortion rights, for example, is actually the one in between, the one that says abortion should be legal in most but not all cases, or people who say abortion should be illegal in most but not all cases. And in that gray area, there's quite a lot of the population and quite a lot of room for subtlety and nuance as opposed to one side views of it.
Now, in terms of positive or negative, are social issues usually turned around to be negative, or are they candidates and campaigns espousing a positive view of that particular element that gets them traction with the voters?
Yeah, often they are used as negative campaign elements, but not always. I think you see that with the same-sex marriage issue now as one that is being used more affirmatively as something that people are ready to support and campaign on. I don't mean necessarily here, but in a more general perspective. Abortion, I think, has been more often used as a negative issue. And immigration is an area where negative campaigning maybe has been a little more common than positive campaigning. Marijuana legalization, interestingly, is kind of a new issue, and we find the voters here in the state about evenly split on that issue. And because it hasn't been talked a lot about or campaigned on in the past, I expect that's a case where we're kind of more open to what political leadership might point to.
Yeah, interesting. They might not exactly know what they're getting themselves into with an issue that hasn't been fully tested, I guess.
I think that's exactly right. There have been a few referenda elsewhere in the country, but even in Colorado, for example, where marijuana was recently legalized, the governor has said he has concerns about how that's going to play out. And I think a lot of governors, at least in other states, are taking a bit of a wait-and-see attitude. How does this work out? What are the problems that come up? Or does legalization turn out to go fairly smoothly? We don't know, but we have a few states that we can now watch and get a sense of.
All right. Well, Charles, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Have a good one.
We've been talking to Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and the founder of PollsAndVotes.com. He's been shedding some light for us on some of the social issues that might influence the governor's race as the campaign season unfolds. This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up in Wisconsin Life, we meet a 19th century painter who captured the beauty of Wisconsin farmscapes.
First, though, a new analysis from Oxford Economics finds that American workers don't always use the vacation time that they are eligible for. Among people who get paid vacation time, about 4 in 10 workers leave time unused, an average of 8 days a year. Add it all up, you get about 429 million vacation days left on the table. That is more than 1 million years of vacation time abandoned every year.
What does this say about attitudes toward work and leisure in the United States? Well, we called up Al Genie to get his thoughts.
He is professor of business ethics and chair of the Department of Management at Loyola University Chicago's Quinian School of Business. His books include The Importance of Being Lazy, In Praise of Play, Leisure, and Vacation.
And Al, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very, very much for having me on. I wish I could say to you I was in the backyard on my chaise longue, either smoking a joint or the Jack Daniels, as your ad.
Waiting for the zombies, yep.
Waiting for the zombies, but I'm still at work.
Oh, you're
still
at work.
Here for about an hour after we speak.
You're supposed to be our ambassador for leisure time, Al.
I understand that, but as many of my friends pointed out to me over the years, I wrote that book to save myself. I'm not sure I've read it enough times, but I certainly have been a student of that. Can I go back and ask you, four in ten, I know that, leave that. So you're suggesting 8 hours a day. How many hours are you suggesting are built up over a year?
8 days a year added up, you get 429 million vacation days left on the table in a single year. That's a lot of vacation time that people are not using.
In 1 year, it's true. Well, the statistics that have been out there for a while is that most people don't take their full vacation, and they leave about 5 days on the table, but for all sorts of reasons. And I think the reason part is really critical. That is it family? Is it the pressure of business? Is it economics itself? I mean, since the recession, and my wife and I happily are, and luckily, travelers, there's been a diminishment of tourists and kind of traditional places, even in traditional places, but certainly in a little more exotic places, they've been begging for business left and right because people have been holding back, even if they have some distributive income, afraid of the next drop, so to speak. But I think what's happened is we have become a society of workaholics out of necessity and need, and also out of simple habit. And because we're always afraid that if we miss a day, we could miss a moment.
So we could be left out when the guy or gal down the hall gets a big move and spends time with the boss, and we get left out of the loop.
Absolutely. And I think the American Leave Act suggests that very clearly, that most women do not take the full amount for fear that, you know, the last thing you want to hear after being gone from 12 to 20 weeks on a maternity leave or a family leave is, gee, we're so glad to see you again, but everything's been fine since you've been gone. You know, you don't want to hear that.
You don't want to hear that, yeah. The place fell apart while you were gone.
Right,
yeah.
You want it exactly so, or that, my gosh, we realize how much we miss you and needed you, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that those obvious things come in, but I think we've also lost the ability to play. And, you know, I've been thinking about play a lot. And I think, unfortunately, because we work so long, that we think play is any time we're not working. And that's not true. I think play is something much different than simple leisure or simple relaxation. I think it's the need, you know, this enjoyment, this fun in and of itself, that it's not connected to lifestyle or life needs or life requirements. For the last 40 more or more years, I don't want to admit my age. I was got on public radio, but I'm in my 80th decade or 8th decade. I played handball, and just recently, a group of us have been together for over 35 years. We're all starting to get injured because of age, one thing or another. Who's missing and not missing? And what we're lamenting the most is we miss playing. It's not just exercise. And when we look back on it, we started playing handball because it was a quick way to exercise without jogging and, you know, doing aerobics and doing everything. But then we realized what we liked most about it is we were playing. How many men or women still play? And that's what's missing from our vacations. And because we don't know how to play, we very often don't take vacations because we don't know what to do on vacation.
Well, don't you think that it's also in the best interests of, you know, whoever we work for that we're well-rested, happier, less stressed out? Supposedly, you turn in better work when you're all of those things. You take your vacation time and you relax and you play.
Well, I think you're right. I know you're right. All the statistics suggest that people who have a little more leisured time, people who have more space, people who have downtime actually come back and are more creative. I actually, on Sundays, because, okay, I'll have to admit this. Hi, I'm Al. I'm a workaholic. On Sundays, I force myself to do no thing that's connected to work. Yes, I'll read, but I won't read anything in the area that I'm working on. I'll read my novel. I'll read something else. But I will not do work, even if I'm dying to do it, because I'm afraid of burning out. I'm afraid of burning up. And I think that everyone knows that. So I feel actually I could do more in the next couple of days because I've been refreshed, recreated, so to speak. But here's the reality. The bosses have the same pushes that the workers have. So they're not recognizing that absolute need as well. And so they're not taking as much vacation, and they're not offering it to their employees, even when it is a good and solid business move.
Well, on the other hand, though, you hear about places who are doing away with vacation time altogether, saying you can take how much vacation you want as long as you get your job done. In fact, you're going to be doing an interview about this next week, the results-only workplace movement. So there is that as a counterpoint. But on the other hand, Americans leaving all this time on the table.
But I think that that's a very specialized case. I think we're talking about this new generation of workers, these knowledge workers, who work on these projects that are connected to this computer-based electronic age. We're not talking about surgeons. Surgeons don't work. I do brain surgery on Monday and Tuesday. Wednesday, I do therapeutic dance. Friday, I do pottery. And Thursdays, I just veg. That doesn't happen. Those are 24/7 kind of jobs. And I do see, even finance industry, so on and so forth, these little movements towards, as long as you get your task done, you could take off. Now, if I remember correctly, some of these places pay you and some don't pay you for the time you're off, but you get paid for the job. So the money incentive is a little different. But how many jobs work that way? You know, how many jobs have? Well, if I get it done by Tuesday, I'm off the rest of the week because I finished my project.
Not many. So does that mean we need the bosses to say, you know what, you guys got to start taking your vacation time and we mean it?
Yes, I think we do. I think that the level of mental health in regard to health itself, maybe Obamacare. And if we're not going to, let's not talk about Obamacare because we'll be just yelling at each other somewhere along the line and getting calls that way. But if one of the thrusts of Obamacare is preventative medicine, not just getting medical attention when you need it. And I think that is more recreation, more physical activity, more exercise, better eating, et cetera, et cetera. But more recreation. I wonder, you know, the nursing industry for a number of years has been doing the 3 to 4 week. 4 day week, that is, you get 40 hours in 3 days or 40 hours in 4 days, and you have a 3 day weekend or 3 days off because I think they rotate. I don't see why that's not possible for many of us, all of us. I know universities for a while, but now they're not doing it for other kinds of financial reasons, had Fridays off. That was a study day. Now, academics were expected to be in their office, the professors, but they were supposed to be reading or studying, not necessarily, you know, doing the regular part of the job. I think we can restructure work to give us more time, but I think we're also creatures of habit. We're also afraid of what that might mean. We're also afraid of losing time, losing status, and losing stuff.
Do you think we're also maybe getting too much of our personal self-worth from work, that we're not spending enough time developing relationships, and instead, you know, all of our carrots from the universe are coming from work?
I like all your carrots in the universe. I'll take two bunches of these. Before I wrote The Importance of Being Lazy, I wrote a book called My Job Myself, which exactly argues that, good or bad, we get our identity from our jobs. And if we're lucky, we have good work, we have good identity, and we feel good about ourselves. If we have bad work, we still get our identity, and we don't feel so good about ourselves. I think we do. You know, think about it. You go to a meeting, and we used to call them, you know, smokers, that we don't do that anymore, and or make it a meeting of men initially. It isn't. You don't walk through the room and hear people say, "Hi, I have three children, or I'm a hang glider fanatic, or I love to jog, or I collect bees, or I collect stamps." You hear name, rank, and serial number. "Hi, my name's Bill. I'm a divorce attorney. I'm a this. I'm a that. We brand ourselves by our job labels, and we get identity from that.
We're talking right now to business ethics professor Al Genie. He's the author of The Importance of Being Lazy. And we're talking about American attitudes toward vacation and leisure after a study showed that we leave 429 million vacation days on the table each year cumulatively.
You can join in the conversation, too, at 800-642-1234. If you get paid vacation time, are you able to use it? Do you want to use it? And have you ever left some of it just to wither away? Do you feel the pressure to work more and leave less? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us, talk@WPR.org. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with business professor Al Genie, author of The Importance of Being Lazy. And we're talking about work and leisure in the United States. A new study shows that we leave millions of paid vacation hours on the table each year.
And you can join our conversation. Do you think we're workaholics in the United States, that we spend too much time working and not enough time at rest or play? Do bosses, do workplaces place too much emphasis on coming in and not using vacation hours? Should workers be blamed for that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. And we're going to go to our phone lines now. We have Guy on the line from West Allis. Hi, Guy.
Hi. One of the things I think could be happening is that people are afraid of losing their jobs, especially in the lower end of the socioeconomic scale. If somebody has, 3 weeks of vacation, but they don't use it all, but somebody else does and they do use it all, and then it comes around time for layoffs and it says, "Hey, Joe never took all of his vacation last year, but John did. He's being more productive and staying here more at work where we perceive things being more important. He's the one that's going to stay, and the other gentleman's going to be the one that gets laid off."
Right, yeah, really interesting point, Guy. Thanks for that. And Al, what do you think about that? That seems like a real concern that someone might get penalized for taking their vacation time.
It is a real concern, and I think every difference does make a difference when you got to make a tough call at work. And even though you don't want to be partial or unfair, of course that's going to make a difference. See, he took his vacation. Can I depend on this person as much as this person? All other things being equal, that may push it over. But I think that is a valid point to bring up. But I think there's a larger issue here. I think this is more of a cultural pattern, a multifaceted cultural pattern, than a single cause. If we could, if it was a single cause, we could get it or get close to it, we could eradicate it. But it is this multiple reasons, economic, sociological. People are simply workaholics in the worst sense. Don't forget, workaholism, for some people, is an honorific, something they brag about, but also it's a way of coping with life when you can't deal with it in any other way. If I stay busy, at least I'm not depressed. So I wish there was a single answer and that I could write that book and give that answer and become more than a professor and be a guru along the way, but I do think it's multifaceted.
And we're going to go next. By the way, thank you for that call, Guy, and we're going to go to Ryan in Milwaukee. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks.
So my problem is I'm a multi-unit retail manager, and it's not that we aren't given the opportunity to take time off or that we have to be concerned for our jobs. It's more that it's so difficult for us to take time off. We have so many restrictions on when we can use the days or, the proper coverage that we have. So I just wondered if we had any suggestions for that.
Yeah, that's really a tough one. The analogy here is when you own your own small business. every time you're not at work, you're not making money. Especially if you can't, if you don't have other help, or it's two or three family, you know, person family business. When do you take off? When is downtime? Et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's also the problem of a lot of professional people. I mentioned surgeons before. We found out that in various areas of medicine, that people aren't going into the more glamorous areas because it means a complete abdication of free time, an abdication of your own ability. Even if you are in a partnership or three or four people are doing the surgery, that more and more, especially women, are going into fields that they can go into clinical, you know, a dermatologist, et cetera, where they're not always on call and they don't have to be there. Unfortunately, I think that the example you're bringing up is job specific. And, you know, and you can't be, can you close your restaurant at Christmas time? It sounds like madness. Do you close a retail store at Christmas time, et cetera, et cetera? The answer is no. And so I think there are jobs that simply require us to be there on a regular basis. And people find it very difficult to carve out a private life because of that.
So, Al, does this make it especially hard for families and especially hard for women if we are being punished when we take vacation time?
Well, it's hard for women because, unfortunately, even though women now represent 51% of the workforce, and even though women are now climbing up in the various executive positions, et cetera, women still have are one down in the workplace. And every time a woman makes a mistake, it's what the former female mayor of Chicago said, Jane Burns. When I make a mistake, they don't say, "Oh, that darn mayor made a mistake." "Oh, that darn woman made a mistake." Right. Mm. So she always had to be three times better, which I still think is the ratio that women talk about now in the professions. You have to be three times better than your male surgeon, three times better than your male co-pilot, et cetera, et cetera. I think women suffer from this a great deal as well. A woman I interviewed for one of my books said to me, "I don't know what I feel bad about more. The kids, every time I miss a function," she was working full-time plus, "every time I miss a function at school, I know I've missed it and it won't come back again. The job, which I can never, ever get enough time to finish it. This house, which we had to buy, but now we sleep in, we don't really live in. Or my husband, whatever his name is." You know, and I think this problem is more poignant for women because, again, they dare not make a mistake. But I think it is a cross-cultural problem.
And let's go back to that. Let's go back to the calls. Let's see. Justin is next. We're going to take his call from Milwaukee. Hi, Justin.
Hi. It speaks very well to my point. I work for a very competitive employer in the Milwaukee area. I have a college degree, but my employer simply gives us 3 weeks of vacation time, but then makes it very hard for me to take it by allowing no flexibility, no coverage, no extra person to pick up the slack when someone wants to take a week off. And I know that, for example, I had a child last year and I was entitled to 2 weeks of paid paternity leave. I never took it because I knew if I took that 2 weeks, it was going to be 6 months for me to dig out of that pool.
Right,
couldn't see myself doing it.
Right. Thanks a lot, Justin. And Justin describing that same kind of scenario, kind of like frequent flyer miles that you can't use.
Right. You know, and I think that Justin's brought up a really wonderful point. When firms say we give you 2 or 3 weeks, do they set up an internal support mechanism by which you could actually do that? My wife, I'm in a mixed marriage, by the way. My wife is a lawyer and a Republican. That's my standard line. But she gets 4 to 5 weeks off, but the firm works around that. It is an established cultural part of this. Now, she's in a boutique firm that is under 200 lawyers in Chicago. That's kind of small. But they actually set up mechanisms by which that can happen. Now, the truth is she could rarely take five. It takes about 2 years' notice to take five at once. But she does take all of her time. And in one of those lumps, it's 3 weeks where we go on our major vacation during the year. But that's because there are mechanisms in the firm. You could say you get 3 weeks off if you can fit it into your schedule or fit it into the needs of the company. Well, that's a formula for failure.
Well, thanks a lot for your call, Justin, and good luck to you. And we're going to move to Nick in Sussex. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
What do you think?
I guess I just kind of had a kind of not necessarily totally on the topic, but I'm an Army reservist, and I do construction in the Army, whereas my civilian job is in an office. So when I go to my once a month or 2, 3, 4 weeks out of the year to go do laborious work, I come back and do my office job and sit at a desk and my computer all day, and I feel quite refreshed having that kind of opposite sort of work once in a while.
So that's kind of a vacation. It sounds like to you toggling between two very different jobs and a lot to juggle, too, on the other hand. What do you think, Al?
Well, I think this is like cross-training. I'm getting old and I'm too lazy to do it myself. I have a trainer 2 days a week. And the trick is he works me like a dog but never does the same thing every day, so I'm not totally bored by it. And it winds up being refreshing. I think that it's all about timing, timing, timing. Think about this. What's your favorite food? Then think about eating that food three meals a day, 7 days a week, you know, ad infinitum. It's soon not your favorite food. I think breaking it up, even and it comes to the Latin word divertio, to be diverted from, or divertirsi in Italian. To do something different always adds a little spice to the job. So even something like doing a different job for a while may be a good idea. In fact, the famous model for that, of course, I think is Volvo, who years ago trained a person to do a number of jobs and also trained their partner to do a number of jobs so that you not only could do many jobs on the line, that you could job share with your partner. But that's a very, again, complicated cultural arrangement that takes a great deal of time, money, and effort.
Al, do you see this problem we're talking about, people not taking their vacation, being too invested in their job or too scared to go? Is this an American phenomenon? It seems like the Germans are pretty good at taking vacation,
yeah.
Or at least so I hear. Are there things that we could learn from them?
I think in Germany you start off with 3.2 weeks. I think you start off with over 3 weeks a year as guaranteed on every job. I think that was true. When I wrote to my job, The Importance of Being Lazy, I'm sorry, those statistics were true. The Germans had the highest number than the Swedes, and so on and so forth. But where, you know, the Americanization of the world is occurring, and because of tough economic times, they too are crunching that. Don't forget the French, one of the elections we're fighting about, they had gone to 35 hours. Well, they're back to 42. The Italians mm-hmm. have increased the workloads here and there. So I think that it's happening across the world, a little slower, and they're still fighting it in a very real sense. But it is, I think, a problem all over. We're in China this time last summer, and that was a problem in China, that when do we get off? We have now this wealth and this extra income, but we don't have time to spend it. An interesting problem indeed.
All right, Al, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your time.
I appreciate being with you.
We've been talking to Al Gini, professor of business ethics and chair of the Department of Management at Loyola University. His books include The Importance of Being Lazy and Praise of Play, Leisure, and Vacation.
German immigrant Paul Seifert lived a varied and creative life in the driftless region he called home in Wisconsin. He painted vibrant watercolor farmscapes in the 19th century that are now highly prized by collectors. Wisconsin Historical Museum curator Joe Kapler tells us about Seifert, the man, and his work.
Paul Seifert grew up in the eastern part of what eventually became Germany. He came to Wisconsin in 1867. 1879 is the earliest known painting date, and it seemed that he did most of his work in the 1880s. And then it seemed to tail off, that's our understanding. But in that time, he also started doing paintings on glass for sale. He really got into his taxidermy business. He was also a bit of an amateur relic hunter, we would probably call that person today. And so he spent endless hours, I'm sure, in the hills and woods in the Wisconsin River Valley. He became associated with Charles E. Brown at the Wisconsin Historical Society, probably the first professional archaeologist. Not many listings in the newspapers about him at the time, but if there were, they talked about details like his lush gardens and his great tomato crop. So this all-around very interesting, creative person lived on the land, worked with his hands, both physically as a farmer, but then also as this delicate painter. One of the best photographic images in the exhibition is a photograph taken of him late in life. He died in 1921. He appears to be sitting on a porch, kind of reflectively, and his hands are in the foreground, and they're large, strong hands. And I love the image, and I think that really encapsulates Seifert as this guy who could do just about anything. He didn't paint what he saw with his eyes. He painted what he envisioned, you know, in the mind's eye. The perspective that you see in almost every one of these paintings is, we're a little bit back. We're a couple hundred yards back from the farm. We're 100 feet in the air. give or take. When you visit some of these farms today, you'll see that the perspective of the painting does not exist in nature. There was no hillside just across the way that he would perch on. Bird's eye maps were already the practice of making and selling bird's eye maps were already well established by the time Seifert was even in Wisconsin. And it's a similar perspective in these bird's eyes. There's larger, more grand, and higher up, further back. Perhaps he was inspired by that, or perhaps the vision was entirely his own. We're putting that out there as a possibility. You know, both my parents grew up in farms in northeastern Iowa. And so I have probably a little natural affinity to that. And then doing research over the last 5 or 6 years, occasionally kind of getting out into what I call Seifert country, I've kind of fallen in love with the natural landscape of Richland and Sauk and Iowa counties. But then this guy is such a great story and such an, he's this interesting cat, you know? And I think too often history overlooks people like that or dismisses them as kind of fringe characters. And why shouldn't we hear from him?
An exhibit of Paul Seifert's work is on view at the Wisconsin Historical Museum in Madison through August 30th.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Catch more Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television Mondays at 8 p.m. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
For more on Paul Seifert, Joe Kapler joins us in the studio now. He is the curator of cultural history at the Wisconsin Historical Society and the curator of the Paul Seifert exhibit that we've been talking about. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Well, it is great to have you here. You described Paul Seifert as an interesting cat there. And, you know, it brings up I've lived in Wisconsin my whole life. And when I looked at the pictures in preparation for this, I recognized them from somewhere in the back of my brain. But I'll be honest, I did not recognize his name. Why is that?
Paul Seifert and his work is very interesting because there's kind of a duality to the people who love and cherish his paintings. Certainly locally in Richland, Sauk, and Iowa counties, he's one of their own. He's a folk hero, and he's also a folk artist. There's a lot of colorful stories attached to Paul Seifert. But in the last 50 or so years, his works have been discovered by people. There's like that aesthetic. It's kind of similar to Grandma Moses' paintings. And those folks who love his paintings are coast to coast. And so some of those paintings leave the state when they hit the art marketplace out there. So you could maybe meet somebody in the Northeast, New York State, Connecticut, etc., and they might know his name more readily than you might meet someone from Milwaukee area or Green Bay or something like that. We kind of feel sometimes that's our job at the Historical Society is to fill in those stories when needed. All too often, like I referenced in that piece, maybe history focuses on more mainstream, if you will, figures, artists, etc. This guy is a great story, and his paintings are very evocative as well. And they're laden with details, and many people can access them from very different vantage points.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the paintings. You mentioned in the Wisconsin Life piece, we just heard that sense of perspective that he used, you know, kind of far back. And the sense of perspective is, I guess, primitive, that the way he draws buildings and so forth. But the colors are so vivid that, you know, 120 years later, they're sort of leaping off the page. And I'll be really interested to see what they look like in person because they must be very, very impressive.
Yeah, they certainly are. And to your point first about the primitive aspect, and that's sometimes a label that may get attached to works. He certainly struggled a little bit with single point perspective. Some of his proportional dimensions are a little bit off here and there. Some people like that. That's part of the charm. But certainly he's providing a vision that no one else that we know of was doing. But you mentioned also the colors and the vivid nature. Most of these paintings were probably done in the 1880s and 1890s, and many of them that were preserved well, either intentionally or kind of by chance, they fool you. They don't pass the eyeball test. They look too good, too crisp, too clean. The reds are too
you know, red is the first color in the spectrum to exit, usually, if you will, to fade away. And some of these are just have the red detail. And one of the first tours I gave day after the exhibition opened, someone looked at a painting, an original painting, one of 17 in the show. They looked at that painting and said, oh, I see you have some reproductions here as well. It's like, no. You know, we work very hard to pull together original material. And these paintings came from around Wisconsin and actually around the country. But a few of them look like they could have come off the printer yesterday.
And as I understand it, some of the paintings he painted on commission, and sometimes he just painted views because he liked to look at them and liked to paint them.
We really don't know exactly how or why, you know, the particulars of his process. Mm-hmm. And I'd certainly love, if, you know, for folks listening, if they may have some information. There's a lot of colorful stories and legend, if you will, about Seifert. Did he trade these for room and board? Did he commission? We really don't know. I'm sure it's kind of word of mouth. These paintings, the farms were all probably within about 25 miles of Gotham or Richland City. Not Richland Center, but Richland City, the former town washed away by the Wisconsin River. And Seifert never wrote in a journal or anything like that, or there's no diary accounts. There's no contemporary accounts. So when I've been doing interviews and talking with people and groups, ask somebody out there has or remembers a letter that grandma talked about this guy who came up from Gotham and he knocked on the door and he wanted to know if he could paint the farm. You know, I would love to know if that contemporary documentation exists, because what we have to work with now are his paintings. They're left to speak for to Paul Seifert. But as a historian, we'd love to be able to dig a little deeper as well.
So you've got 17 on display as part of this exhibit. How many has he done, and do you suspect or do you hope that there are more out there that we haven't found yet?
Our latest research indicates about 45 watercolor farm paintings, a few non-farm paintings that were done probably from about 1879 to the 19-teens. 17 in the show, and like I said, came from all kinds of different sources, and we appreciate people making their paintings available for us to share with everybody. Since the show opened, probably learned of 6 more paintings.
Really? That's got to be cool.
Certainly, yeah. And some I may have knew of. They were published years ago, and some are new discoveries, if you will. And for our purposes, we're always trying to add to the story. And just because the exhibition ends on August 30th doesn't mean we're going to, you know, close the book on Paul Seifert. We're always looking to build the story, and who knows down the road if there are other projects that can new discoveries can inform. But, you know, just today, you know, one thing I love about the job, when the phone rings or you open an email, you never quite know. And I learned of another one today, and that's wonderful.
Wow, that is really, really interesting. And the show runs through August 30th?
Through August 30th. A couple events real quick. Tomorrow at noontime, part of our lunchtime lecture series, Drew Stevens from the Chazen will be over, our colleague. And then Tuesday on July 22nd, evening dinner program where we pair in this case, Graham Reed, curator from the Museum of Wisconsin Art, who's going to talk about folk art in general in Wisconsin. And we pair that with food and drink for a great evening event. So check out our website or give us a call.
And those events here in Madison. Joe Kapler, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
We've been talking to Joe Kapler, curator of the Paul Seifert exhibit for the Wisconsin Historical Society.